Hello and welcome to the Practical Tech Leadership Podcast from Venturi's Voice. I'm your host, Andy Davis. In this show, I'll be chatting to C-level executives from all sectors about their careers in tech. The show aims to bring you insights, anecdotes and stories from like-minded professionals that you can learn from and apply to your own career. If you like the show and want to hear more from us, you can follow us via SoundCloud, iTunes or Spotify, or join us on Slack. Thank you and enjoy the show. So we've got Leon Goldman here. He's the Chief Product Officer and Chief Strategy Officer at L-Squared. He's also the founder, of course. Leon, absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you.
First thing I wanted to ask is just the level of entrepreneurship. You seem to have a real flair for it, obviously invested in numerous companies. Before we get into that, how did you even get started? I mean, it's an incredibly impressive kind of CV and portfolio to look at in brief. But where did it all start for you, this kind of entrepreneurial journey?
So I guess I've kind of a software engineer by passion. So I actually finished a art degree and I started building a bunch of art, like generative stuff using computers. And I really got into the software part of it. So I decided to reject a master's in art and continue working in the industry because I really enjoyed solving real problems. And then as a software engineer, I got concerned with how all the different parts of the product and of a business have been coming together. And I just wanted to control more and more, to be honest. So I started L-Squared with two other engineers. And we slowly started to take over the entire value chain. So kind of the engineering back front, the product design, the usability, the business, the strategy. And then we were incredibly lucky fairly early on to start working with Google. And that was a great client that allows us to work on very interesting things, gave us quite a bit of kudos and allowed us to experiment. So we spent a few years working with VCs, founders and angels and building companies with entrepreneurs that don't have any experience, prior experience in technology and products. So we would build the teams around them, validate, take out MVP, a first version to the market, validate the business, try problem solution fit, and we would take equity when we do that. So we built a little portfolio of companies we were invested in. Some of them went to Y Combinator and got further along. Some of them are died. Some of them are still here. Really, really fun.
Amazing. Oh, right. So that was kind of the model then, is it? Like, you would, correct me if I'm wrong, just so I understand that. So you help kind of build the companies and take a piece of kind of equity out of them. That was the model, was it?
Yeah, that's right. So we would invest our sweat, so put the studio resources behind and take equity in this. So kind of like a startup studio model. It's quite common. Mm-hmm. We didn't take it as far as setting up a fund, which what you need to do if you're really mm-hmm. serious to pursue that as a business. You need to start a fund to kind of follow up, because if you don't follow up, it becomes not a scalable business, but you know, something that is nice for you as a, on an angel level, have an investment in a business. But that was essentially the progress. I have a little bit of equity here and there with companies that I consult with as well.
So, you know, the kind of initial vision for L-Squared, curious as to whether that's kind of remained consistent or whether you've sort of been agile in kind of how you perhaps originally envisioned the company model going. Has that changed, or have you managed to be kind of consistent with what the in original idea was?
We actually changed significantly in the last 2-3 years. We're, as we didn't want to set up a fund and do everything that has to do with that, we saw an opportunity in corporate landscape, mm-hmm. FTSE 250 and now also mid-tier corporate, to come in with a service and an offering that is different to what is provided by the incumbents. So we help these guys either launch new products and services, new digital products and services, where we work as part of a digital transformation agenda. And again, We come in with a more execution-oriented, a modern startup process than you would find in traditional consultancies or in the Big Four or the really big integrators. So kind of enterprise consumerization of enterprise software through the process and also the level of output is what we're interested in.
Interesting. So, you know, the original idea for it then, like to go back to that, how did that come about, if you can remember, I suppose?
Original idea for what?
Elsewhere.
For Elsewhere. So I think, like I said, we come from I'm an engineer and my two other co-founders are engineer. So obviously our CTO is an engineer. My other co-founder is director of design and customer experience and is also an engineer, which is a very unique DNA for the company. And we really came from a maker approach of we just want to get out of our process, the type of quality we can be proud of, be able to deliver at quality, work with the best people on the market, use the latest technologies, being free from the shackles of VC capital, and just execute really, really great outcomes. That's purely what drove us and still does today. So it allows us to bring in people that are interested in that sort of culture, that are interested in excellence and in making and in great creating great products. And that's the seed behind what we're doing.
So you mentioned that like kind of avoiding the shackles of the VC. So did you not kind of pursue fundraising through kind of venture capital or anything? And if not, was it just very much like organic growth, like growth for profit? Was that always kind of the vision?
We're completely self-funded. So we never taken in any investment. VC money has, we never tried to approach and get that. I don't know how interested VCs are in service companies. I think you can probably get investment as a service company, not from a pure kind of classical technology VC, because just the growth is just not there. You can't get the same multiples of growth as you would get with a pure technology play. However, I've been in this ecosystem for a long time to appreciate the benefits of not having that. A lot of times comes with a cost, which we don't have to pay. And I guess we're closer to a little bit slower building a sustainable business, building a business that grows responsibly. I don't want to kind of turn very negative light towards, you know, a VC powered growth. I think benefits and there is also drawbacks, and the drawbacks are kind of known, I think. So we don't have that, and that's great, I think.
No, it's interesting because I think it seems to be very much the culture within startups, especially that you tend to find that people are almost like publicizing how much money they've raised, and like that, I suppose that has ultimately been kind of glorified. But you know, and I think it's almost got to the point where it's become synonymous with success is like how much have you raised in a Series A or B round. And I think that it can be confusing to a lot of people that isn't always necessarily something that you should strive for. Like you say, it's not, I'm not kind of saying that it's not valuable to obviously raise capital. It obviously has its benefits and helps accelerate growth, etc. But yeah, I do tend to find that it's very much a culture that's come from the States, and I do see it becoming more and more the norm in the UK, where perhaps it hasn't always been quite as in your face as it was in the US.
I think it works. That's the problem with it, is that in the of the day, it works. I don't think anybody came up with a better model to take over a market using technology. And, you know, it's a little bit like, well, if we had some kind of a different model, we would be here and things would look differently, maybe. But history got us to where we are. And this is the model that has been repeatably successful over and over again. So I just don't know if there is a better alternative to grow a tech company, not a service consultancy like us, but a tech company that builds a tech product without investment is incredibly hard. Very hard. I think that one of the things that we were allured by, and that's kind of why we went on this kind of startup studio journey, was the 37 Signals. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
No. Please explain, though.
The 37 Signals are the company that did Basecamp.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So they are famous for, and, you know, they wrote a bunch of books about the journey, and they're really great guys, and they blog and put out great material. And they've very much positioned themselves against the VC culture because they were a consultancy that came up with Ruby on Rails, essentially, right? So they came up with Rails and they came up with this open source technology, and they were implementing it with clients. And then they started building tools that they started selling. One of them is Basecamp, and they never took VC money, and they kind of created this story, which is very compelling, of, you know, building a startup on the side, growing it responsibly, and it becoming a great business. And it appeals to a lot of different people and companies, but it's incredibly hard, you know, arguably maybe even harder than properly going on the proper VC pony show, you know. And there are companies out there, like, for example, Atlassian, they never took capital up until a very, very late stage. So Atlassian kind of grown without VC capital. They took VC capital relatively late. I don't know exactly the dates, but they took it only to make acquisitions.
Right.
Their first raise was, I don't know, like, significant. And they'd done that just so they could grow through acquisitions. Up until then, they didn't take any VC capital, which is pretty extraordinary considering it's an Australian company on the other side of the earth, you know, on the other side of the world. I think that I just don't know many other models, and the VC model is repeatable. What does it leave in its path, you know, in terms of, I don't want to say destruction, but, you know, it's an aggressive model. It burns people, that moves products aggressively forward, sometimes on expense of employees, other investors, users, competitors. There's a lot of drawbacks to it.
And that was just something that was never appealing to you, I assume.
I don't know. I can't promise you that if someday I'll start a new company, it's not going to be a product company. It's not going to be VC focused. But I'm sure that I would, even if I did that, I would do it under different, I would do it more aware of what it means than if I was doing it 10 years ago. You know, like, I can see, I've been through kind of, I've been involved in the startup ecosystem, and I know a lot of founders of companies, and I know a lot of people that either had a successful journey or had a non-successful journey, and kind of spoke to them and learned what it meant to go on that VC roller coaster. So I think it's different if you do it, if you sign up for it a little bit knowingly versus not knowingly. But again, until you actually do it, you don't really know what you're talking about, right? So, but I think we have the benefit of not having the drawbacks. And we not necessarily, because of our model, need those levels of investment. Because what I find is that the really, really big money goes to marketing and sales. You know, Aggressive takeover of a market, aggressive kind of penetration in market and succeeding in that market, either a first mover or as a competitor that squashes the competition. You know, that's what really VC money is for. It's not the Series A or even B. It's the firepower that you need to be able to really scale up aggressively.
Just to move on a little bit about some of your kind of the mentoring that you do now, what was the motivation for doing that as well? Do you think it's because you've had, like what we talked about, I suppose, a good perspective on the whole startup scene? I know you're a mentor at Seed Camp. You know, where did the motivation to actually kind of, you know, invest some time into helping some of those startups?
Well, I think this is kind of back to what I said about 37 Signals. That model of, okay, how can we grow a startup on the side was very compelling. And we started to discover this whole idea of having a startup studio. So basically, how can you do consultancy that doesn't just end up in in billable hours and selling service, but becomes something that is a little bit different. So kind of a model of, you know, where you have, we plant seeds as well, something that potentially can grow. And we've done that quite naively, I think, in terms of understanding how that can be scalable, because we didn't really understand that. But it was a great journey. So we consciously wanted to be able to play the startup game, offer that to also our employees to be able to work in on startups and constantly work on new ventures without actually going on a journey of becoming a VC funded product company. And 37 Signals played a big part of that, of kind of looking at them going like, okay, maybe this is possible.
General interest at the moment, obviously, you work within products. What do you think some of the larger innovations are? You know, you talk about consultancy, people, product, you know, in your case, process, technology. What areas do you think are kind of, right as we speak right now, most compelling from an innovation perspective?
From innovation perspective, I think at the moment would have to be defaulting to AI. I think that probably, and I'm not talking about like big AI in a big sense, but this small AI, so kind of like half-baked AI, you know, the half of it is done still by humans, is still really, really exciting. And the development, you can see that this is developing somewhere. So if I had to choose between the three current hyped technology trend, or it's not really trends, but maybe becoming a trend, which is, I would say, AI, blockchain, and augmented or virtual reality, I would say that I can see AI actually pushing forward. And I'm excited about even the very, very low, you know, hanging fruit of what is possible through automation AI more than I am than I can see on the blockchain and the augmented reality and VR side. So I think on the AR and VR side, we just don't have the hardware. We're kind of stuck. We have the hardware. We don't have the computing power for it to become a really meaningful thing. And I think maybe there's going to be a surprise from Apple, because they put a lot of effort into the software side of things. So the AR kit and kind of the type of tools that they're giving developers to be able to deliver augmented reality on the iPhone is being invested by them. So I think, you know, thinking that Apple could, and if somebody could do it, it would be Apple, to be able to break through with some kind of a variable that allows you to augment, virtual objects over normal field of view. Blockchain, it's just the use cases are very difficult to establish, to actually get the use cases for this technology established. I think there's a lot of barriers to that. and also the kind of the blockchain itself in terms of computing power and et cetera. And then I think AI, there's a lot of hurdles, but it's constantly, I constantly feel like it's being chipped at and it's moving forward. So I think, you know, it's kind of in the background as well. Like, I don't know if you're aware of TikTok, for example. Are you aware of TikTok?
No, I don't think so, no.
TikTok is like one of the biggest, well, the biggest social media product that came into existence, has been successful since Snapchat, which I think Snapchat is quite old, 2012, I think, is Snapchat. I'm not entirely sure, but old by major standards. TikTok is a video streaming application coming from China that is addictive beyond belief. People spend like 15, 30 seconds swiping videos. And really, it's a giant AI product. So basically, in the end, this is a product that is based completely on AI. And it's kind of, you know, not what people imagine when they think about AI. Think about, you know, a semi-sentient being helping us to cure cancer, but an application that gets people hooked up to more social media. But the convergence between the human and the machine through that application is starting to happen on a more kind of compounded level than what we get in Facebook feed, if that makes sense. It ability to predict what you want to see, for how long, etc., is what the product is about. You know, if in Facebook the feed and feeds algorithm is a byproduct of the system, in here that is the product. All the rest is just layers being on top of it. The AI is the product. And that's a very different beast to what was happening till now. And I'm not saying that this is a good thing or a bad thing. I'm not trying to judge it, because a lot of people, I think, might think, oh, this is a really bad thing. You know, we're taking this even into a worse direction. Could be. But what's interesting to me is that this is a product that is completely based on AI, that is trying to very consciously, in a way that probably just something coming from China can, use your dopamine receptors to get you integrated with this piece of technology, which is, it's kind of striking, you know. And the stuff that is happening with Elon Musk's product, the neural net, there's just like things that are popping up on all over the place that make you feel like AI is going somewhere. So I find that incredibly exciting.
Do you think that, because obviously the similar sort of situation you have with automated vehicles, for instance, I've had someone on the show talking about automated vehicles in some detail. And the thing is, what I was curious to get your opinion on is with AI and similarly to automated vehicles, is that the AI works on like a local level, like a local environment. But does it need that infrastructure at mass, at scale to support it? Is it a similar problem or that you can foresee with why perhaps we've had these technologies for so long, but the practicality of it is not all the way there just yet? Or are you under the belief that we're pretty much nearly there now?
I think that, well, in terms of scale, I think seriously, the only companies that can seriously contend on building significant AI progress is the likes of, you know, the big tech companies, so the GAFAs. Plus, anything that comes out of China, because China puts its muscle behind AI, and China is very conscious about building AI and becoming expert in AI, you know. And they're very conscious about it, and they're working very hard to get there. And in a lot of people that understand much better than me these things consider China being on the front, actually, and ahead of the US or the UK in terms of implementation and actually working products. I'm not sure about, you know, in terms of scientific papers, etc. So in terms of scale, you need that sort of scale for it to be meaningful. It's just, you just need shitloads of data that can learn. So that's in terms of scale. In terms of, yeah, I get it that a lot of it is based on, you know, scientific papers from the 60s and the 70s that we just now started to implement. But I think there is a lot of research that is moving forward. I'm not as a researcher, so I don't know to, you know, to meaningfully state how much of it is cutting edge new stuff, how much of it is just, you know, incremental buildup, but of what was there. But what AlphaGo did is significant, even if a lot of it is based on work that's been pioneered on in academic sense somewhere in the 70s. You know, so we are breaking through the barriers of muscle power. We are breaking through the barriers of finding utilization and meaning for this muscle power. And we don't need to get all the way to, you know, general AI, meaning that AI that can self-learn a problem and kind of utilize that knowledge to come up with new solutions to make meaningful changes to our lives, for better or for worse. It's just there for the taking, and it's coming. And there's a lot of investment going into it. And if you had to understand how behind we are as a public to understand what the meaning of that is, just look at Facebook's, you know, newsfeed and its congressional hearing, and it really I think contrasts really well of where society is in terms of understanding where this technology in Guayana was doing for him, and where actually technology is. And we're still at the very, very, not even day one of this thing. We're like in the first second of what this technology can do. Does that make sense?
You're really one who is, you know, usually optimistic about technology. I don't know why this has been a theme, or perhaps you might be able to have an assumption, but a lot of the people who come on the podcast, they kind of see that the main innovations are going to come from really like people or processes. But obviously you've still been, I suppose, quite bullish on, you know, directly associating innovation with technology. Those that aren't doing that, I think it's quite obviously tempting to, you know, associate the two synonymously, I suppose, these days. But for people who are, I suppose, almost making the point on this podcast to say, you know, the people and process side of things that we really want to see the innovation from, where do you think those kind of motivations and that kind of opinion is coming from?
I find it maybe a little bit difficult to pick up this point because I haven't heard these specific arguments. To me personally, when somebody says something like that, it sounds a little bit like innovation in a corporate sense, maybe, like, you know, unlocking the corporate machine to allow people within the organization to innovate. I think that's a very, very big part of unlocking existing structure to be able to move forward. I think that companies like the GAFAs or startups, they don't need help innovating. You know, they're self-perpetuating innovation machines. They don't even use probably innovation as a word in the organization. I think innovation as a word exists usually in organizations that probably have difficulties with innovation, because in companies where innovation truly happens, it's just part of the fabric. I think people are constantly inventing new stuff, and the culture is set up for that. It just happens, and it might happen slower, it might happen faster, it might happen by other business processes. You know, being able to, as Facebook in whenever it was, I can't remember the year, swallow up WhatsApp and paying the outrageous amount of money for that, or being Google buying YouTube at the time and spending the amount of money that was laughed at in every business newspaper. Innovation, mm-hmm. You know, that's innovative thinking. That's part of culture of innovation. Even if we're not talking about coming up with a new AI algorithm, but being able to understand where the future is going and react to that, that's something that these tech first companies do as just as you know, as fish breathing in water. They don't need specific structures to be able that to happen. I think once there is constructs around how do we unlock processes for innovation, how do we, that to me usually signals that the organization is potentially struggling to do that and is looking for ways to enable that. And that's incredibly hard, you know? And that's usually in the context of companies that are older or are not naturally technical. So I think if that's the context of the conversation, then there's a lot of work that needs to happen in terms of process, a lot of work that needs to happen in terms of culture. And I actually don't really know a single super successful poster child of being able to do so.
Great. I'm conscious of time here, Leon. I could literally ask and talk to you all day long, by the way. Kind of limited by time. So I want to, perhaps we do a part two, actually. I think we've got plenty more to discuss. But before we do, just to anyone, I suppose, wanting to learn a little bit more about Elsewhen, perhaps know if there's any like careers available, where can people go to kind of check out and keep up to date with all the latest happenings at Elsewhen?
So elsewhen.com/blog. We blog a lot and we have a lot of guest bloggers that write about interesting developments in financial services and insurance and technology and all the different sectors we're working in. Follow our LinkedIn page, where we trying to bring really, really interesting and well-filmed content, which I think is really different to what we've been seeing in LinkedIn so far. So we think we have something different to say and produce in terms of quality into that as well. So yeah, and if you want to chat with me, just email me directly. I would love to have a coffee with anybody who's interested to have a chat about technology and product.
Leon, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time and sharing with us today. It
was Thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed this.
Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.